On the line, I have Professor Susan Cahill from Trinity College Dublin, and we're going to be talking about her new book, Dementia and Human Rights. Good morning, Professor Cahill. How are you?
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm in great form. Thank God.
Good.
Professor, we met up in the Helix at the Dementia Conference. And you were telling me about your new book and that it was going to be coming out. Could you maybe just tell our listeners about it? And I note from one of the press releases, dementia should be viewed as a disability. Can you expand on that for us?
Sure, yeah. Well, I suppose traditionally dementia has been understood as a syndrome caused by diseases which are characterised by plaques and tangles and brain scans, drugs, tragedy, suffering, passivity, and at the extreme, probably locked doors and technical clinical care. And having worked in the area, I've worked in the area for over three decades, both in Australia and in Ireland, and there was really a gap in our understanding, I felt, of dementia from a social justice and a human rights perspective. So as an example, we tend not to think about dementia as a disability, and certainly not as a disability rights issue, thinking about concepts like equality, participation, autonomy, non-discrimination. And, you know, Michael, we've seen wheelchair users and people with all sorts of physical impairments unite and demand a better deal from governments. But when it comes to dementia, a similar type of rights-based movement has been very slow to emerge. And I think we're still stuck in the groove of chronic organic brain disease models and that personal tragedy theory, which really leads us nowhere and it's very nihilistic. So I saw a need really to interrogate dementia using a human rights lens. And that's what I've done in the book. The first three chapters really set the scene and argue that dementia is both a disability. It's also a human rights concern because people are at heightened risk of having their fundamental freedoms denied of them, like, for example, privacy or the right to a diagnosis or to its ethical disclosure. And then basically I move into really in the chapter 4 and 5, interrogating policy and practice using the UN Convention as a prism to look at the issues and to examine the extent to which people's rights are being respected and promoted. And then I bring that together by looking at the WHO's Global Action Plan on Dementia, which is heavily rights-based, is discussed in the final chapter where these issues are brought together. So it's really trying to look at dementia from a different perspective, and trying to encourage and urge the dementia community to have the these rights, the UN Convention rights, applied more forcefully to dementia. And, of course, these rights give people entitlement or the potential for entitlement to legal protection and to services and to really enjoy a better quality of life, something that we would all aspire to.
Just to pick up on something you said there, you mentioned about people with other disabilities
sure.
coming together and you know, fighting for their rights.
Yeah,
I spoke to a young lady from Beaumont a few months ago, and one of the things she said to me was that how she's in a wheelchair, and she explained how that when people meet her and stand over her and look down on her and speak to her that way, it makes her feel, you know, how it makes it feel. And
of course, and inferior and subordinate. And, you know, again, with good training and with public education, I think people should be encouraged to lower their stance in talking to people in a wheelchair and communicate eye to eye, really. I mean, again, in the book, I get into the whole area of the way people with dementia are othered. They're set apart from the rest of us. And the language we use is very important in terms of the way we view people and we view the world. We tend to talk about people with dementia as victims and sufferers and family members as carers who may be the hidden victims. And really, that language doesn't really achieve very much. It really distances people with dementia from us. After all, you know, many of us have already the plaques and tangles in our brains that will lead to us getting a dementia. So it could be us in a matter of time. And I think, you know, the one thing that dementia does, it clearly robs people of their, you know, their cognitive functioning and their memory, but it doesn't strip them of their humanity. And it's really the public and society that erects artificial barriers that, you know, causes people to lose their human rights and have their, you know, humanity be eroded.
One of the interesting questions I think you pose was, should a person with dementia lose the right to make decisions about matters that affect them?
Yeah, and that's a very complex area, really. It's to do with autonomy and with Article 12 of the UN Convention. And thankfully now here in Ireland we have very forward-thinking new legislation on assisted decision-making, the new Assisted Decision-Making Capacity Act, where much less restrictive, you know, views of autonomy are understood, and where this will give people much more opportunity to make decisions and choices and express their preferences for what they want to do.
I quite agree with
you. And Chapter 7, I have a chapter in the book written by a human rights lawyer from NUI Galway, and that chapter really looks at those issues in great detail.
It's something that I think everybody, or virtually everybody in Ireland, every family in Ireland, at one stage has had to deal with somebody that has dementia or Alzheimer's or whatever you want to call it.
Sure. There's about 55,000 people in Ireland currently who have dementia, and they say for every one person who has the illness, about three family members are affected. So it's very, very widespread.
And it's a very, and I know personally myself, and I think I mentioned this to you previously, both my mother and my grandmother suffered, my grandmother with Alzheimer's and my mother with vascular dementia.
Right.
The difficulty and just the internal struggle within myself on my mother's there, and you know, she was trying, you could see that she was trying to communicate.
Sure.
But what was in her brain and what came out her mouth were two different things.
Sure, sure. And I suppose the real challenge is to, for relatives, is to put our detective caps on and to try to work out what the person is trying to communicate. And, you know, a person with a dementia still has feelings and can still perhaps express themselves non-verbally. So we need to really always be kind of aware of that.
Just to point that one out, I have a little story where my parents went away for a weekend, and myself and my brother were left to look after my granny.
Right.
And my granny lived two doors away from us, so she would come over to us and that. But my brother was looking after her for lunch one day, and she came in, she sat down, he gave her her lunch, she got up, she headed off back home. She obviously just reached the gate of her house, turned back, came back in and was looking for her lunch again.
Right, right. So she had forgotten, so her short-term memory had been affected. But, you know, oftentimes people ask the same questions, or their behaviour may be just an expression of an unmet need. She may just have been in quest of human contact. Well, that's why she returned.
Funny you should say that. So my brother at the time is a lovely lad, but he has a short fuse.
Sure.
And he was... His grandmother, who he loved, just keep asking him the same question. He was starting, he describes this himself, his blood pressure was just rising and rising and rising, and he was about to explode. And then he looked at her, and she looked at him, and he said it was like a cloud. This is the way he described it. It was like a cloud just fell over from her eyes. And she looked at him and she said to him, "It's a terrible thing getting old."
So, you know, again, a reflection of her own insight. And people who have dementia, who may be very disorientated, will have moments of great lucidity. And, of course, we must respect that. And we must really make full effort to communicate with the person.
Jill, I'm actually getting emotional thinking about it, because she was a great woman. I have to say, she was the hardest woman I ever came across.
She was, in what way?
Well, every grown man in the area feared her. She had a tongue that would cut you in two. Now, she had great love in her, and she would do anything for you, but she didn't suffer fools easily.
Okay. And did that continue throughout the period where she had dementia?
Oh, she was 10 times worse.
Okay. So people's personalities don't really change, and often, you know, their traits become more accentuated with advanced dementia. But it sounds like she was cared for in the community, which is so important, and where most of the 55,000 people in Ireland who have dementia are looked after by family members who do wonderful work. And if that work was to be valued economically, and if the government was paying for services, it would cost the government a fortune. So people are really around this country offering their family members wonderful support. And there's fantastic service providers out there working in nursing homes and in daycare centres, and very creative work going on, which I must say, you know, is a new development in dementia care here in Ireland. And wonderful to see the type of non-pharmacological interventions being used, and the approaches now. There's a far better understanding of dementia. The HSE anti-stigma campaign has been very effective. There's more services coming on stream. And I must say, the future, I clearly think, looks much more optimistic for people who have this illness and for their family members.
Well, you probably heard through the promos there that next week we'll be hosting a number of the ambassadors for the Sea Change and the Green Ribbon program, you know, the Mental Health Awareness Month.
Right, yes, I did hear that, yeah.
And we were at the launch of it yesterday, and the big point that was being made yesterday was, funny enough, just what you said, is it's removing the stigma from mental health. And I think I mentioned this to you up in the Helix as well. When we think of people like Terry Pratchett, who went on working for quite a number of years while he had the early stages of dementia, and probably, some would say, produced some of his best work.
Absolutely, and did wonders for dementia in the UK in terms of attracting funding and going public, and really kind of highlighting, you know, what the subjective experience is like. But we also have fantastic advocates here in Ireland, people like Helen Rochford Brennan and Ronan Smith and Cathy Ryan and a whole host of other people who are going out there and talking about their experiences and talking about their human rights and really pushing for better recognition of the needs of people with dementia.
So,
and in fact, Helen spoke at the launch of the book last week, and such a powerful presentation, you know, from a first-person perspective. And she's somebody who, like about 4,000 other people in Ireland, have this young onset dementia, which is an unusual dementia and which presents its own challenges because it presents in people under the age of 65. And again, in the book, I use Helen's narrative, which is very, very powerful in describing the journey she had to actually arrive at a diagnosis, being kind of fobbed from one person to another until finally, I think it took about 5 years for her to get a diagnosis. And these are a group of people who are very, very vulnerable and somewhat neglected in certainly the Irish health and social care services, because there are no services for young people here in Ireland, and no post-diagnostic services either.
So how do we change that?
How do we change it? Well, we have a national dementia strategy now here in Ireland, and that's currently being implemented. And there's a new office set up in the HSE Office for Dementia, and a lot of very good work going on, led by very competent people who really are very dedicated to the area. And I must say, I'm hopeful that in time we will see changes. We're already witnessing some of these changes, and I think the future looks, quite optimistic.
We have to look at our economy, and our economy is growing, but we're just coming out of a serious recession, and there isn't a huge amount of money around available.
Yeah, well, good dementia care does require money, but it's not just all about money. It's about attitudes, it's about training, it's about understanding better the individual's life story. For so long, we've been, again, stuck in the groove of just looking at the neurological impairment. We need to look at the person from a holistic perspective and think about, you know, what works for that person, what their needs are, what their interests are, and really try to really improve that person's quality of life.
Well, you've taken the words out of my mouth. When I was working in business, a lot of the times, I know, when we went looking for money, what we were told was, work smarter. And by that I mean is that we have a tendency to try and put a one-size solution for fits all.
Sure, sure.
And that often costs far more than if we actually start to look at what the individual needs are. Because a lot of times somebody doesn't need a huge amount, they just need a little bit of over here, and that frees up resources for the people who actually need far more.
Exactly, absolutely. It's not really all about money at all. It's about creating the right environment, having staff who understand dementia, who want to work in the area, who bring out the best in people, who identify people's retained abilities, who promote autonomy, who aren't obsessed with reflections on risk, but want to actually give people more independence and not have them be de-skilled, say, as an example, in nursing homes. And that does take training, but it's so important.
Professor, I haven't read your book yet, but I've read the notes on it, and it looks really interesting. I believe it has sold very, very well.
Well, it sold very well at the launch, and I haven't checked with Hodgetts Figgetts to see how it's gone since then. And it's really just one way. I mean, there's different angles at really understanding dementia. And this is only one approach. And I must say, I'm not taking credit for the disability perspective. That's already been introduced by other people who are much more expert than I am. But it's really interrogating dementia using the UN Convention and trying to highlight the injustices that people experience, both community-dwelling people as well as those living in residential care. So issues like diagnosis, disclosure, the rights to multidisciplinary assessment that would lead to good rehabilitation, the rights to living independently in the community, and then for people with a more advanced dementia in residential care, the rights to be protected against cruel, degrading and inhumane treatments. And in the book, I look in particular at both chemical restraints and physical restraints, and then the rights to privacy, because a lot of people in nursing homes may not have the opportunity to really have a private conversation with a relative because of the kind of layout of the bedrooms. And then the rights to basically good cultural, recreational, leisure time activities, again, very pertinent to life in a nursing home, where so often people can be quite bored and activity programs may not necessarily be tailored to their needs.
What I like about it is that it asks a lot of questions. It gets me thinking, and you know, I would be somebody who would have an interest in this field, but it has certainly opened my eyes to other questions and got me asking myself these questions and thinking about them. And I think, you know, if anyone out there...
And that's really my intention, to really, you know, be provocative, I suppose, and really to challenge conventional thinking and to level the playing field, because in the book I bring in the narratives of people with a mild dementia who are still very articulate and, you know, talk about their experiences, and placing the individual at the center stage is so important, and providing an ethical and a robust framework for practice, which the convention actually does, is also very relevant.
To be honest, I find asking the questions somewhat liberating, that it frees things up, it gets people talking, and gets people gaining an understanding of what they previously would have just accepted. They're now questioning.
That's right. And I guess the country has recently ratified the UN Convention, and that means that the government has entered into an international agreement to convert its principles into both policy and practice. So the government must really ensure that all policies, including dementia policy, complies with the UN Convention. And so that ratification is very important for people living with dementia. And again, we need to watch that space, and the dementia community needs to kind of be on the alert to really monitor what's going on there.
Professor, I'm afraid we're running out of time. Can you tell, where can people get your book?
The book can be purchased from Hodges Figgetts in town, and also it can be bought online through Policy Press in the UK, who are the publishers.
Professor, once again, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Michael, thank you very much indeed, and you take care of yourself.
All the best. Have a great weekend.